Hey, it's Dolla White, and this is the Dolla White Podcast. White privilege is real. One of the many ways it rears its ugly head is in our healthcare system, where throughout history, black people have always received less than when it comes to healthcare compared to white people. Here today to talk about racial disparities in healthcare are Dr. Karen Winkfield, radiation oncologist and executive director of the Meharry Vanderbilt Alliance, and Dr. Sonia Reed, who is the assistant professor of oncology at Vanderbilt. Once again, I am by far the dumbest person on this podcast. Let's get it started. Welcome to the Dolla White Podcast.
Pull up, get it. Live.
Yeah, what's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
Right here.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat-out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolla White Podcast.
All right, episode 25 now of the Dolla White Podcast. My guest today, I hope I don't mess any of this up, Dr. Karen Winkfield, radiation oncologist and executive director of the Meharry Vanderbilt Alliance, and Dr. Sonia Reed, assistant professor of oncology at Vanderbilt. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We're going to talk about racial disparities in healthcare. You guys are doctors, and I am not that intelligent. I am a dirty nightclub DJ, so let's get it started. So what is the number one thing people should know in regards to racial disparities in healthcare?
I'm happy to start this one, and then Dr. Reed can kind of come in and layer on. So one of the things that I am so passionate about, the reason why I'm doing the work that I am doing as part of the Meharry Vanderbilt Alliance, is that Black people are dying of disease at much higher rates than any other racial or ethnic group. And it doesn't matter what that disease is. It could be cancer, which we are both oncologists, so I would like to spend some time talking about some of the cancer-specific disparities, but we're also talking about diabetes, cardiovascular disease, HIV/AIDS, child and maternal fetal health, right? There are, across the board, if you look at the issues related to health, health care, access to well-being, Blacks are suffering. And it's something that we as a community of Black individuals need to be aware of. And we need to start advocating not only on behalf of ourselves, but of our families and our communities on how we can actually do better, not only for ourselves, but for our communities to help change the dynamics. And there's a lot of reasons and rationale for it, but I want to let Dr. Reed, you know, certainly you can kind of weigh in terms of some of the things that you see.
Yes, for sure. So I'm a medical oncologist, specifically a breast medical oncologist. So I take care of breast cancer patients. And with that, we know that breast cancer, as we know, it's the most common cancer among women in the U.S. and in the world, right? And when you look at the numbers for breast cancer, it's quite stark. When you think about the mortality rates, Black women with breast cancer have a 40% higher death rate than their white counterpart, right? Like, let's just start there. And then you start unpacking, but why? And I like to think of it almost like a perfect storm, so to speak, because we know it's not just one factor. We know social determinants of health play a role, access to quality healthcare. We know there are biological factors that play a role. Just where you are getting treated in this country and in this world does impact your outcomes. And I think that's something that we definitely have a lot more work to be done in that space.
My best friend passed away in 2012 of a disease called sarcoidosis that generally affects Black people and not white people. He did not know he had the disease. I believe he had just had a physical. It's just not something that you get checked for unless you have like big symptoms, which he didn't think he had, obviously. Otherwise, he would have gotten checked. Is that another one of the problems? Is that because a certain type of disease or a certain disease doesn't necessarily affect people across the board, that we're just not doing checks? Had he been checked for sarcoidosis, had he been tested for sarcoidosis, there's a good chance he's still alive today. Because he didn't, he passed away suddenly. Is that one of the problems?
Well, let's just say, first of all, there are some diseases that we do have screens for. Sarcoid is not one of them. We don't do routine screening for it. So even if people are going to their physicians on a regular basis or primary care providers, that might not have been something that was screened for. However, when people have symptoms, however mild that they may be, if they have access to a healthcare provider, it makes it easier to say, oh, and by the way, I'm having trouble breathing. Here's one of the challenges amongst Black and brown people in the United States in particular. They oftentimes do not have primary care providers. So if you think about what happens, a lot of time people go to the urgent care centers or emergency rooms for their care instead of establishing primary care relationships so that when there are issues that pop up, when there are issues that aren't standardly screened for, they have someone that they trust that they can actually have a conversation with. And so this is a huge thing for cancer, even. We only have a handful of cancers that we can screen for. And so we know that, unfortunately, Black and Brown people in this country are not even getting screened at the same rates as other racial and ethnic groups. So you're bringing up this topic of, well, what about in a situation where the disease, there is no screening for it?
Right.
But one of the things that is potentially part of the issue is, are we even establishing relationships with healthcare providers? And a lot of times the answer is no. And some of that has to do with some of the mistrust or distrust that has unfortunately been part of the history and the fabric of this nation.
Absolutely. And I told you I had Dr. Hildreth on a couple months ago, and we went through that as well with the awful things that have been done to Black people in this country when it comes to medicine. What should make people feel better about that? What laws are in place that should make people feel better about that now?
That's an excellent question, because, you know, that's what a lot of us in the field are trying to take baby steps in that direction to build that trust, because it has been decades, right? Decades of people not trusting their doctors and nobody doing anything and everybody turning a blind eye, right? So then how do you turn that needle now and say, no, we want you to be a part of our studies. We want you to come and get primary care doctors here. And I think it's going to be, as Dr. Wingfield mentioned, tiny steps, developing that trust with our patients, being in the community, going out there, letting them see us in the communities, not just when it is that we need something from them or we want them to join our trials. Then we're like, hey, come and join our trials, right? Making them know that we are a part of them. They can see us being Black doctors, letting them see that space that we also want to be at the table. We also are making those calls. We also are trying to be a part of those policies, right? Makes a difference for patients to know that we're not just saying the thing, and but we're actually a part of the doing of it. And I think that matters.
Yes. And there are things that are put in place that are safeties for patients, right? So even in terms of the access issues, if you have a, for instance, a person who's in the hospital, say you're a family member, you don't have access to their data, right? You can't just go up and say, I want to have information about my mother. Oh, my mother's in the hospital. Tell me how she's doing. They're not allowed to talk about that. And so there are laws and protectors that are now in place, not only for patient information, but it includes their tissues. So people might think of, well, look at what happened with Henrietta Lacks. She was being experimented on, her tissues were being used without her consent. There are now laws on the books that prevent those sorts of things from happening. And so it's important for us who are in this space. I'm a clinical trialist as well. I believe in research. That's how we drive the needle forward. That's how we innovate, is actually doing research. But we need to make sure that the research is broadly applicable across lots of different types of individuals from a race, ethnicity, you know, socioeconomic standpoint. All of that matters, but we need to make sure that we have established trust with those communities. And so I think it's really important for those of us who are in this space, who are doing this work, to say, look, there are safety checks in place now. We can't just, you know, do a Tuskegee, right? We're not allowed to just, you know, take on like, and just, I'm going to do an observational study on these people who have disease and not treat them. Like, we can't do that.
Right.
And it's really important for folks to know about those safety measures.
Do you think if the United States had a healthcare system like Canada, do you think some of these things would be better if everybody had access to healthcare?
Yeah. I guess I'll go first with my thoughts, because okay, that's all that it is, my thoughts, right? Because I'm originally from Jamaica and there's free healthcare in Jamaica. So I'm kind of familiar with that structure that has that universal healthcare, right? I always think about it like that. Access is one level, but then we have to make sure that the quality is something that everybody has access to, that high quality level of care, right? Because giving someone access to healthcare, for example, and they're not gonna get radiation, because this is a real life example I'm mentioning, for example, back home in Jamaica, they're not able to get it until 9 months, right? Because of the system. So I think having something and just saying, we're gonna make it universal, also puts in place its own unique challenges, the logistics of how that will look. Can we realistically get people in a timely fashion? Will that compromise the quality of care that we're able to offer, right? And I think those are issues that I think have to be ironed out in tandem with just saying, let's everybody have free healthcare.
You're bringing up a really important point because I was in Massachusetts. So I was practicing at a hospital in Massachusetts where we had Romney Care long before there was Obamacare, right? So we had universal coverage. And I always used to tell the institutions that I worked for, because they were like, well, we don't understand why people of color aren't walking through the door. I said, access goes beyond just having medical insurance. Having an insurance card, having coverage, that's not enough. It's about what is the environment like? Is this an inclusive environment? Do people feel safe and welcome when they walk through the door? Or if you're a Black person walking into an institution, do you get the side eye, or you walk up to the desk and people are sitting there talking, you know, with their friend and texting on the phone and not even acknowledging your presence, right? Do you feel welcomed is an important part. When you're talking with providers, do you feel as if they have your best interest at heart? So access to healthcare goes beyond just having the ability to walk in the doors. There's a lot more to it. So while I think some things would be better, including access to screening, et cetera, it's not everything. And we're seeing that with COVID. And think about COVID-19. We have vaccine available in this country. We have lots of vaccine available in this country that's actually sitting there, not getting used, right? It's free. People aren't taking it, right? So there's a trust issue related to safety of the vaccine. There's a trust issue with respect to who's actually administering it. There's a trust issue with respect to which one of the vaccines you get. There are all of these issues, and there's an access issue. Where is it being delivered? Is it close to people where people live? These are the same factors that come into play with respect to the healthcare system overall.
You said something in there that kind of sparked this question. Is there a problem, particularly Black women, when they go to their doctor saying, hey, these are my symptoms, this is real, and a doctor blowing it off? How bad of an issue is that?
I can't say I know how bad, but what I can tell you, I've heard that story. That's why I always empower my patients, be your own advocate. And that's why even for our family members, a lot of times, I can't count how many times I have to be like, make sure you ask this question. No, demand a CT scan. No, know this, know that. Because it matters. And in our communities, it is real. I mean, we have all those history, right? Where people think Black and brown people don't feel pain as much. Your skin is thicker. Like all those things that people were actually trained with those kind of metric for decades, right? So like on learning those things, building those trust and making people take you seriously sometimes, it's not as easy, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to be your own advocate. That's what I always tell patients, be your own advocate.
Absolutely. But it is hard. And again, we're seeing the same thing in COVID, where literally people will have respiratory symptoms, will go into the emergency room, be sent away because somebody's being overly dramatic, and then that person dies at home. We're seeing it.
I would think as a doctor, you would err on the side of caution in that person.
Now, here's the thing, and let's not put all doctors in this bucket.
Of course.
Remember what happens in the emergency room setting. There are healthcare providers, and not just physicians that are seeing patients. So sometimes there are other individuals making decisions, but I think implicit bias is real, right? People come to their work with their own biases. And I agree, I do tend to be a little bit more cautious, but there are certainly times where I will say to a patient, you know, well, why don't we wait and see? Why don't we give this some time, et cetera?
I do want to ask you guys about diet as well, because I'm vaccinated. I've got the COVID vax. I've had both my shots, so I'm not anti-vax or anything like that. But I do feel like, especially in the past year, there was a race to a vaccine, but there wasn't much emphasis on maybe we, all of us as Americans, need to eat a little bit better. Maybe we need to take some vitamin D supplements and things of that nature. There wasn't much of a focus on that. It was just felt like a race to a vaccine. Put your mask on. Don't be around these people. But it's also a lot of you need to treat your body better. And I don't feel like that message is really pushed a lot by the medical community. Personally, I don't see it. Maybe you guys do in your own realm, but it doesn't feel like it makes it to wherever I'm at in the world.
So you are speaking my language. So first of all, you're talking about prevention. COVID is different. The pandemic is different. Look, if we didn't do a race to the vaccine, and we say race like kind of with air quotes, because people do not understand, the coronavirus family has been studied for decades. Like the technology for the mRNA vaccines has been studied and utilized in the past. It's not new. None of this is new. What is new is the strain of the coronavirus. And so there was a race to develop an active vaccine against this particular strain. But nothing else is new about this process. Let's make that clear, okay? But what you're talking about is prevention and disease prevention and health promotion. And those are the things that are important. But guess what happens in the United States? Physicians and healthcare providers do not get paid to do that work. Mm-hmm. We get paid in this country to treat diseases. And it's not fair, like, to say, well, then the medical establishment needs to do this, but then the insurance companies are dictating what happens. So there's a disconnect between what is really the most important thing, which is prevention and wellness, which is exactly what you're talking about, and what the expectations of a provider are. And so, again, this is why it is important for those of us who do not have primary care teams or primary care providers to get one, because that's where some of those conversations take place, frankly. And so it's not at the time when you come to see an oncologist, although I'm sure Dr. Reed can share with you what she says to her patients, and I do too. I talk about the importance of weight loss and nutrition, all that kind of stuff in my work. But by then, they already have a cancer diagnosis. Yeah. There are things to do to prevent.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what came to my mind when you mentioned it is what we think of as food insecurities. In some communities, when you think of a grocery store with fruits and vegetables, like, we take that for granted in some of our communities that we live in. But if you go into certain communities in this country, getting access to fresh fruits and vegetables is a luxury, right? And we have to think about when we tell patients to eat a healthy diet, right? To do this, to do that. Do they have access to those things that you're telling them to eat? Can they go running on the road? Do they feel safe to go jogging? Right? Like, we love to, like, say these things in theory, but we have to really think about when we're asking someone, go and exercise, go and diet, and then they come back 3-4 months and they're not doing it. Why? Do you have the resources, right? What are the barriers that you're stumbling into that's preventing you from being able to access these life-changing habits that we love to talk about, right?
We actually talked about this on the Three Black Docs podcast because cost is important. We talk about socioeconomic status, which is income, occupation, and education. Those three things are the top drivers of health and well-being. And it's important for just those reasons. You know, it's expensive to eat well, right? To eat fresh fruits and vegetables. I can go to McDonald's and get like a $4 meal and be able to feed like two people. So those things are important.
I make a pretty decent living, and Whole Foods hurts my feelings once a week. So, I mean, I understand. Now, there's not a system in place that makes taking care of your body easy or inexpensive if you're living in poverty. It's almost quite the opposite. It's almost impossible to do at that point. For that, though, do you have tips? Is it go to the farmer's market, maybe? Is what are some tips if you don't have it to live a healthier life?
Yeah. So, number one, yes, the farmer's market is cheaper. However, where are the farmer's markets and are they accessible? Can you get there by bus, right? Like, again, the people who are living in poverty oftentimes may not even have the transportation means to get to some of these other places. And that's why in this country, we have food deserts. In the United States, one of the wealthiest country in the nation, we have food deserts where people do not have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. But there are other ways to do things. Frozen vegetables and frozen fruits are ways to do that where the nutrition is locked in right there. They're just as good. I would prefer frozen over canned. So that's one thing. The other thing is really reducing the number of processed foods that we're eating, right? So again, people eat a lot of this kind of stuff that we don't even know what ingredients are in there, but really starting to look at the ingredient list on things, having dried beans, those sorts of things have lots of protein in them, but they're real cheap. You can get a thing of black eyed peas for what, 50 cents or 59 cents. So part of it is a re-education and making sure that we're being culturally sensitive, right? So not everyone wants to eat an arugula salad. You know, not everyone does. And that's okay. Like, I enjoy it. But there are some people who might want to have a piece of fried chicken every once in a while. And that's okay, too. But how do you do it in a way that is done in moderation, but also done with really the pocket in mind and cost?
I think that's excellent. And that's kind of what I always try to figure out with my patients. What do you like to eat? What are your eating habits? Because they may be different than ours, right? And also, because Dr. Wingfield kind of touched on the diet part, I also like to talk about exercise, especially in the breast cancer realm where we know that's linked to reducing your risk of recurrence and all that. I always get into a whole spiel with my patients a little bit about the benefits, right, of exercise, not only to prevent a cancer diagnosis initially, but also to reduce that risk for recurrence. And we know that there are different gyms across the country that, for example, give you different, discounts, et cetera, depending on your income. Or if you're a breast cancer survivor, I know there's like ABC program that give you a free. So there are different opportunities or different programs around the country that patients don't even know exist, right?
Right.
And without us being a little bit more responsible and helping our patients navigate those things and try to kind of empower them with these resources that they know exist, which we know sometimes they are not in their communities, but trying to figure out, okay, you live here, where can we plug you in that will help you figure out some of these resources? It takes extra time, but sometimes you really have to just be that advocate for a patient and really spend, even if it's an extra 2 minutes, I think it would be time well spent.
If there's one tip you guys can give beyond diet, exercise, and, you know, seeing a primary care physician to take care of your body and try to prevent cancer or any other kind of serious disease, is there anything else besides those three things?
You know, I would say education is important. You know, people need to be aware. And I think the more we can do to educate ourselves, the better off we're going to be. And I do understand that for some people, when you say health, that might not be the first thing that's the top of their list, because they're like, you know, light bill, rent. There are other priorities that people have. But let me tell you something. I think we define health the wrong way in this country. When you look at the definition that the World Health Organization has, it's really a total sense of spiritual and holistic well-being. And that's what we really are all after. So that includes, you know, reduction of stress, et cetera. So information is key. Knowledge is key. And my hope is that people will really start to prioritize the things that make them healthier and that they are able to have more well-being in their lives as part of their daily, everyday kind of just doing them.
Yeah. And I think I'd so echo that. And I'll take that with a slant. Empower yourself. Empower yourself. Be your biggest advocate. Know your body. Know what's right for you. And when someone tells you, no, you are fine and you could, and then you should go home. No. This is, I know my body. Like, know your body and take charge. Like, nobody knows your body like you, right? And yes, as doctors, of course, we're here for patients. But at the end of the day, I think there's a responsibility with really knowing your body, empowering yourself, being educated, as Dr. Wingfield said, and, you know, being your biggest cheerleader at the end of the day.
Last question, and I have to ask this because I don't know the next time I'm going to have two doctors on, but obviously, COVID, a big one. I know you guys deal primarily with cancer, but you know more than the average person about, you know, what's happened the past year. Mask mandates have been lifted in a lot of places. I'm vaccinated. I'm still wearing my mask. Maybe I'm just used to so used to it that that's just going to continue. Where are you guys on COVID? Are you still wearing your mask? I know both of you are probably vaccinated. I would guess you're vaccinated. You're still okay. You're putting yours on right now.
Yes.
Yes.
So look, you know, yes, we are both cancer doctors. However, as I mentioned, I'm the executive director of the Meharry Vanderbilt Alliance, and I'm working with the National Institutes of Health by co-leading their inclusive participation work group for the Community Engaged Alliance Against COVID Disparity. So I'm working with the teams all around the country to reduce the risks associated with COVID and to try to improve uptake for the vaccine, et cetera. My thing is, I believe that there's some political move between the not wearing the mask. Again, if you've been vaccinated, there's less risk. But I still think that there's not enough people in the United States who have been vaccinated. With only 30% of people being fully vaccinated, we're still not clear enough for herd immunity. I think there's going to be a spike in the numbers. I hope I'm wrong, but I worry about that. And so I absolutely wear my mask. My entire team wears the mask when we're around each other. And I think we just need to really be smart around it, particularly if you're around people that you don't know or in crowded situations.
Yeah, ditto that. I wear my mask all the time. I have a 5-year-old at home and he cannot get a vaccine right for now. And he's in school and I treat cancer patients. And I'm on service right now in the hospital seeing COVID patients. So yes, I have a lower risk of getting symptomatic COVID infection, but I could potentially be a carrier, carried home to him. He has not been vaccinated. So I have to think about all those things. So that's my personal responsibility. So guess what? I've been wearing the mask all along. I'll keep wearing it.
I do want to say, and I always like to bring this up, especially with doctors, there is a reason that the life expectancy in 2021 is much higher than it was in 1921. And that is for the work and the research that you guys do on a daily basis. So thank you for that. We're in a better space now with COVID because of the work that you guys do. Thank you for everything that you guys do, because without you guys, I mean, we're out here screwed, basically. So that is what it is. Like, modern medicine obviously has issues, but overall, we're a better human race with it, a healthier human race with it. And that's the work that you guys do every day. And that's amazing. And I thank the universe, God, whatever it is you believe in, that intelligent people such as yourself were made, because if it were, you know, up to people like me, we'd be in bad shape right now. So thank you guys for, you know, being naturally so smart and inclined to this work, because what you do every day is amazing. I mean that.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I want to say thank you once again to my incredible guests, Dr. Karen Winkfield and Dr. Sonya Reed. They were a wealth of knowledge. Don't forget, brand new episode drops Thursday morning. My guest, Hallie Bateman. She's an artist and the author of the new book, Directions. Really good advice for getting from here to there. Really dope episode drops Thursday morning. Once again, thank you so much for checking me out. Don't forget, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, to maybe give me 5 stars, maybe write a nice review, something like that. If you're listening on any other platform, make sure you subscribe or follow. And follow me on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok and Clubhouse and everything else there is as well. At NolaWhite101, DoleWhite101. Brand new episode Thursday. Thank you for checking me out. I'm gone.